Robert, how would you describe what's ahead of us?
Just the beautiful Santa Barbara ocean beach on an overcast day. Like, we just went up, we got back from the hot springs in Montecito, and it was pretty sunny up there. And now, like, the overcast along the coast is coming in, and it's kind of, yeah, I mean, it's kind of there's something ethereal about this.
As I hold the microphone for Robert, I'm shaking because I haven't properly dried myself. Matt is also cold. So, Robert, what have you been reading about regarding religion lately?
Okay, so I haven't been reading about religion. I am reading Matt Pegasus's book, The Black Album. That's just a collection of short stories, and if you want to say that's about religion, some of it is about, like, occultism. And I'm probably going to interview him about that, so I won't get into that too much, but it's definitely an interesting book, and it's worth checking out. As far as reading about, I'm not really reading about religion that much. I mean, to be honest, like, I don't want to sound too much like a Philistine, but because I'm sort of ADHD and I have kind of a short attention span, like, I'm not reading that extensively. But I will say is, like, I've been watching a lot of YouTube videos about these topics. Like, for a while I was watching a lot of Colin Wilson, then Neoplatonism, and then some videos about, like, near-death experiences.
I see. And Colin Wilson, he wrote The Outsiders, and he didn't go to school, right? But he was, like, an occultist.
Right, right. His main area of expertise was, he's a really prolific author. He wrote a lot of fiction, too, but his main interest was on the study of consciousness.
I see. Do you have any, like, odd stories, maybe about his occult, like, practices, perhaps, or anything that you may know that maybe he did, like a cool ritual or something?
I don't know of him really being into, like, rituals, that kind of occult, but I do notice that he's wrote extensive. His main thing was consciousness, so he would talk about, like, the peak experience and, like, doing things to get intensity. So I guess I know some story where his daughter went missing out in public, and then the moment he found her again, he had this intense feeling of joy. Like, that's more what I associate him with, not really. Even though, I mean, he did write a book about the occult, I think he really gets into Crowley.
Yeah.
But I associate more with more kind of, like, with consciousness and seeking out the peak experience and how, like, we become, like, the robot because we go for, like, the day-to-day kind of rituals, like work and being online, and just the need to seek out that peak experience. Or, like, kind of how you get, like, nostalgia, and a certain scent reminds you of the past, and that creates this intense sense of nostalgia. I mean, that is really the essence of Wilson.
Yeah, I have a question, Robert. So what extent do you view your long-standing project, The Stark Truth, your podcast, now a Substack, to what extent do you kind of, I mean, maybe you've already answered it, but you have an affinity for Wilson. You kind of are also this outsider type who's created a body of work on a wide variety of topics. Do you see yourself as kind of a modern take on Colin Wilson? Not to make you say something to flatter your own ego, but I view your work that way, so I was curious. You know, and it's not that you were inspired by him, it's more that you found later he's a kindred spirit, right? And
quick interjection, you guys have known each other for a long-ass time.
Since 2018, and yeah.
That's really long.
Almost, let's see, that's almost 6 years. That's sort of
about
long.
6 years. Yeah. I've known about you for over 6 years, and we met, it'll be 6 years to the day on July 1st of this year, yeah.
But I'm sorry, back to the original question.
Which question? About whether I'm a modern day Colin Wilson?
Yeah, yeah, just comment on the similarity between you and Colin.
Sure, why not? I don't really have much to add to that. If you want to flatter me, like, go ahead.
Yes, I view your work in that
okay.
vein. I view my own work in that vein, too, I'll add.
But. Next question.
Yes. So, regarding, we were talking about what you've been reading, religion, like, regarding religion. In your day-to-day life, what is it like for you to do research? Do you, like, wake up and you're like, I'm going to look at Twitter and then kind of see what's going on while I was sleeping? Or what's your daily diet like?
Sure, I do. I mean, since I'm prolific on Substack, I'm constantly researching various topics. If it's specific to mysticism, sure, but it's like, it's not really like a daily routine. It's more like if I have an article and it's specific to the article, I do extensive research for the articles.
Cool. Do you, do ideas just come to you? Like, you're sitting there, then all of a sudden you write it down?
Okay, so, combination of both. Sometimes brilliant ideas just come to me. Sometimes it's a process of research, and then sometimes I just get this far. So it's a combination of both.
That's freaking cool. Do you accredit, so regarding, like, spiritual practices, do you accredit this ability from meditating that you maybe do sometimes, or, like, doing candle magic or anything like that?
I mean, I meditate, but I can't say that, like, I haven't gotten to the point, like, it makes me more relaxed. But to a degree, like, have I found something more profound? Meditating, like, maybe a while back, I would meditate on cannabis, and I would get interesting visuals would come to me, and then I would use that to write a visual scene for one of my novels, so stuff like that. But not really. I mean, a lot of the most insightful, or you could say mystical things, incidences that have come to me have been more spontaneous.
That's cool, because I've seen some of your art, and it actually looks like, at least the one I saw in Matt's house, it actually looks like it could have even be in Vaporfornia, your fiction books that you've written.
I remember Matt wrote that, how his intro to the book, Vaporfornia, says I'm an artist with words just as much as I am with paint, and it is, Vaporfornia is a very visual novel, so there are these graphic, like, aesthetic and descriptions of every location that the character or their protagonist is visiting.
Cool.
It is also surreal as well.
That's cool.
People say it's like a fever dream.
So was your first introduction to the concept of Vaporwave, was it Macintosh Plus?
Not really, just when the meme really took off, like, I liked the aesthetic.
Cool.
And also the hidden meaning, like, vaporware is, like, a concept, like, something that's put forth that doesn't exist, so it's, like, a play in a metaphor, so it's, like, it relates to, like, saudade, like, nostalgia for what could have been.
Do you think that kind of relates to, like, Mark Fisher's capitalist realism, and that it's kind of you're kind of getting nostalgia, that it's just, like, a repeating nostalgia brought about by capitalism or something?
Yeah, like, nostalgia of an ontology, yeah.
I see. All right.
What is it you want to say? It's nostalgia of nostalgia.
Nostalgia
of capitalism and consumerism from the past, and you're trying to seek, like, deeper meaning from it.
Yeah, I think that's what Mark said. Fucking Matt's doing yoga right now. No, it's good. We like it. All right. Moving on. So theosophy. What do you think of it? Do you think it's the truth? Do you think it's, like, the most level-headed, centrist take on religion? Do you think Americans should maybe be more theosophical?
Yeah, I think it is. Like, the best argument you can make for theosophy is by analyzing near-death experiences. So the first point is because the medical and scientific evidence is strong enough for their legitimacy. So, for instance, the people are clinically dead. Their brains are clinically dead, so there's not... So it's not really a hallucination, and I don't think also hallucinations tend to be more hypnagogic. People with NDEs report that everything is, all their senses and sights are very vivid and intense, so it's not like it's a very different feeling than a hallucination. And then also, they often have these out-of-body experiences where they'll report on something that actually happened while they were out. So there is very strong legitimate scientific evidence for that. And then you take the next step. The next step is that the themes in your death experiences are pluralistic, so they match many different faiths, and some are might be very Christian in themes, but some are very universalistic. But I would say that, like, theosophy as well as Neoplatonism are very much intuitive rather than dogmatic religions, so they make the most sense by studying, like, nature, biology, and psychology.
So one might call this prole drift, that I'm drifting to proletarians right now, but could you define what Neoplatonism is and how that relates to what you just are talking about?
I can't give you, like, a full-blown lecture on what Neoplatonism is, but it was a religion created by, or you could say a philosophy or religious philosophy created by Plotinus in about... He was a Greek from Alexandria who was living in Rome, and he created this religious school of thought in about 300 AD, in the same period that, like, you have the Gnostics and the early Christians were rising up.
Cool. And I like to note...
It is based on Plato, right? Or is that a little bit of a...
There's debate about
that. Maybe less so than it was found. Yeah, yeah.
It's a little bit based on, like, Plato. Supposedly Plato had these, like, lost religious scripts that are gone.
Yeah.
I'd like to point out, regarding the scenery, I'm watching a children's, like, castle they built on the sand. It's being eroded away by the ocean. It's kind of sad, but it's also very beautiful at the same time. Anyway, do you have any psychic abilities?
So nothing like telekinesis, but I have had, like, mystical experiences, or, like, I might find a very strong spiritual reaction to aesthetics or to certain locations, or, like, especially how certain sights and scents help me rediscover lost memories. You could say saudade or, like, lost dreams. But it's more like certain visuals or certain places give me, like, a really intense, like, psychological or ethereal experience.
So you don't think you have ever read someone's mind on accident before or something like that?
Let me think.
Or someone's ever pinged you on the astral plane and you, like, maybe you thought they were going to... You were thinking about them, and then they contacted you right then or something like that?
Well, I've had, like, dreams while I'm asleep and other people in the house are still awake and I hear their conversations. But I'm kind of hesitant to count that.
I see. Cool. Matt, you asked something. Matt was just practicing the LVRP on the beach. Kind of cringe, but it was kind of cool.
It wasn't the LVRP. I picked up a staff and made a pentacle, that's all.
Oh, stick. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to call you cringe.
No, it's okay.
Here you go. Can you tell me about the time that you were meditating and your camera almost got stolen?
Okay, so this was June Lake, the paranormal experience at June Lake, or say mystical experience. So I was out swimming in June Lake, and...
For people who don't know, it's north of Mammoth and here in California. It's an alpine lake.
Yeah. So I just... had this intense light coming in from the mountain, like it felt like pure love, like it's felt like it basically was like God, and very similar to what people report with near-death experiences. And
I don't ask this to question the experience. Had you just taken a benzo, or were you sober?
Yeah, I had a few benzo or two. Anyhow, like Matt was there doing meditating while I was having a real, authentic mystical experience. Like, just, you feel, like, this intense feeling of, like, pure love, and then he's there, and then, like, my camera someone's stealing my camera, and I'm yelling, Matt, Matt! And he's, like, he's there meditating, totally ignoring me, and then I tell the guy,
Christ, what does he want?
And it was, like, there was some young, sort of, like, mentally challenged guy, I think he was Samoan, and he picks up my bag, and, like, I don't know if he was mistaken it, or he was trying to... I have no idea if he was trying to steal from me, or he mistake it for something of his family's, but eventually, I got him to hand it back to me, but Matt was still there meditating the whole time. But anyhow, I want to talk about... I think, like, the experience itself, and how to interpret it. Like, you have to kind of accept these things, like, they're just, like, gifts from the divine. I don't want to analyze it, be too analytical, but it really relates to, like, the Neoplatonist perspective. Like, beauty is emanation from the divine, and it's a total rejection from the Gnostic view that totally rejects the physical world. So, like, it reminds me, there's this meme of this beautiful, like, mountain lake, and it says Gnostics think this is evil. And I mean, that's pretty ridiculous. But it was like, you can take, like, a non-religious interpretation that, like, a scientific, non-secular interpretation just says, like, beauty or being in nature will stimulate a spiritual response. And I don't want to go there. Like, I think there is something authentic and spiritually spiritual about what happened. And again, I would say it was like a gift from the divine. But it was just like, I was in the lake and I saw a mountain on the other side of June Lake. And then this light pouring in from the sun. And it just felt like the essence of God, basically.
That's beautiful. Here's an interesting question. Can ugly things be divine, even if it's like, violent or ugly? Are only beautiful things divine, or can ugly be beautiful just because it's a, what do you think?
That's open to interpretation. I don't know if, like, beauty is the best word, but there's dualism. I believe there's, like, dualism, so something to the grotesque, like, you could find meaning in it. Or you might meet a person and they have these dual characteristics, like they have a beautiful side and an ugly side. It could be like the personality, like they have a good personality but they're ugly and vice versa. But sometimes like you get this weird mixed feelings about their aesthetic, physical attraction, and also like you might go to a certain place and it's kind of like how people find like a romanticism and like the grittiness in certain, like, urban areas, like, it kind of relates back to that theme of, like, hauntology, or even, like, with, like, malls, how malls used to be considered really, like, tacky and, like, epitomized crass commercialism, but now people are rediscovering beauty.
Yeah.
So to answer your question, I mean, I think you actually can, and it's like that question, is beauty an absolute, or is it subjective or objective? And I'd say it's a bit of, there's dualism, so it's a bit of both. There are both subjective and objective aspects to it. There are absolutes to beauty, but there is some like room for nuance at the same time.
Yeah, if I could take a stab, I think you really do need ugliness and violence and hideousness and chaos in order for there to be beauty in order in a meaningful sense. So I think that in that sense, there's different definitions of beauty. You have beauty as an absolute, eternal, Platonic form beauty that... obviously, that is kind of in opposition to ugliness, but ultimately, in a broader sense, you need both beauty and ugliness, and therefore the ugliness itself is also beautiful, is kind of where I come at it from. We're talking about Gnosticism, Neoplatonism, all these buzzwords. I don't know where I position myself exactly with regard to them, but within Gnosticism...
So Neoplatonists believe, like, this world is like a photocopy of the divine, so this emanation. Gnostics actually literally believe that this world is evil and ruled by this Demiurge. Yeah, this evil deity who oppresses us, and the only way to seek like beauty, justice, and goodness is to basically spiritually, like maybe through meditation, but to escape from this world.
Right.
So the Gnostics truly reject everything about this world. They actually don't find beauty in it, which I think that's insane, actually.
No, I do too. That's Gnostics in the most traditional heretical Christian sense. I do think modern Gnostics, like Stephen Heller and others in Los Angeles, I think they have a more nuanced Jungian take on it. I don't know exactly where he stands on the world being evil or not. I do recognize that's the main gist of Gnosticism, but I think there can be shades that may overlap with Neoplatonism. I don't want to necessarily take a firm stance one way or the other, but only to say that, you know, Gnosticism, as I've studied it, you know, through Heller and others, involves, you know, belief in both Abraxas and, you know, the Godhead, as it were, and that you can have both a chaotic God and something more transcendent. I don't think I'm going to say anything very insightful here, other than on the matter of beauty and ugliness, you do need both. And we should go to the restaurant in a moment, but to finish the thought, I'll just say this. Your June Lake mystical experience that I was there for, when you first told me about it, Robert, I'll be honest, like, you've said things like that in the past in terms of, like, experiencing some kind of transcendence, and I haven't always taken it seriously, but I'll admit maybe I was wrong to have sort of brushed it off, because it seems like that particular experience has really stayed with you. And I do respect that, and I do think the divine can be experienced in any number of ways, and whether there is something objective or solely subjective going on is almost beside the point, and it seems like that experience is really authentic.
Here's an interesting question. Robert, may I ask how old you are?
38.
So on the topic of Gnosticism, Carl Jung, he has a quote that says, life doesn't actually begin until you're 40. You're older than Matt and I. Do you think that's true as you come closer to that?
I mean, a lot of people online are going to say that's a cope, but I do think like the spiritual essence, maybe like people become more spiritual at a certain age. That could be like your mind. I think like mentally, like more. I'm like the most productive I've ever been, because in the in my 20s, I had too much, like, that too is. Much, well, I guess you could say, like...
Hang-ups, emotional... Well, I don't want to put my mind, like, more
ADHD, kind of, where I was, like, scattered, and maybe I was more, a bit, could be a slacker, or I just had too much chaotic energy, and I couldn't think straight, and I think right now, like, I'm still relatively young, but I feel like I'm mentally... And overall, like, I'm the most productive I've ever been.
Yeah, I mean, even in my 20s, or late 20s versus early 20s, and that, Evan, that structure you're talking about just got totally obliterated. Or they're still working on it, but the tide is coming in here.
Zeus is taking care of it.
Zeus is taking care of it. The moon's bringing the water in. But, Robert, I resonate with what you're saying. And even compared to my earlier 20s, I feel like my later 20s have been a time of greater focus. I've been talking about this a lot. And something's lost. You know, because that ADHD, maybe that's part and parcel of the fire of youth. It's the fire of youth not finding its, mate, as it were. It's the fire of youth not... It's hard to put the fire of youth to productive ends. It can be the most beautiful thing when you do, but it gets easier as you're older, as that fire calms down to channel it, and I've experienced that too.
My bad, I meant Poseidon.
Poseidon, yeah.
I think we should go to the restaurant too, but here's a good question. When was the first podcast that you guys recorded together?
That we posted on my Twitter. Yeah, that was in 2018.
June of 2018. Well, you didn't post it till July, perhaps. But it was a big deal to me. I was young. I was 20.
And Matt, I think Matt 23? Discovered me because of the Shushu interview. Matt was a big fan of the band Shushu.
Correct. Your interview with Pillator with Jamie Stewart. Shushu discovered January 2018, and I was trying to get your attention, but you were in Europe, and I finally got you to respond to my message in, like, May, and I was over the moon that I got to record a podcast with you.
Matt was, like, starstruck when he first met me.
You were starstruck. What was it like meeting Robert?
Oh, fantastic. He's exactly as you'd expect him to be.
Got it. Robert, talking about Shushu, what's a good...
Shushu,
yeah, XYU?
Yeah. I think we should...
Anyway, wait, one last question. What's a good band, Robert?
What's a good band?
Do you have a favorite band? Like, mine, I think my favorite's the Beatles.
I don't think I have a favorite band. What have I been listening to?
Yeah, just a band. Something, a vibe. Yeah.
I don't know if I say my favorite band or even favorite song, but the song 9 a.m. until 9 a.m., the, like, kind of Euro synth dance song or rave song, I wouldn't say it's, like, the best song ever or my favorite band or song by I think it's called, I don't even know the band's name, ABC? No, that's not right, but I think it's 9 a.m. until I come, that's what it's called. And I heard it, out of all people, Rabbi Shmuley Botiak doing some crazy dancing at a Purim party. And I said, what's the name of this song? And someone said the name. And it wasn't, I mean, I like the song, but it's not the best song ever. But I was just so, like, relieved because I remember that song from, like, my adolescence, like, in around the year 2000.
Also, and it was like Bat Mitzvah, right? So it's...
Yeah, like, the whole, like... Have you some like inside connection like that inspired by like, part of my Natalie Bloom character in Vaporfornia, Virgin of Journey to Vapor Island. But anyhow, like I was just saying, like now I found out the song after waiting like over two decades. Like
play the song in the car, and I'll actually probably I've been throwing caution to the wind about getting I'll just put music in my podcast these days. We'll put it on.
Okay, we're gonna go to the restaurant. I'm gonna skip a rock, and we're gonna go. So here, I'm just gonna grab this rock real quick. If I can find one.
Thank you.
right. We've arrived to the Himalayan restaurant, and we're sitting in the car outside of the place because we want to talk about something we can't talk about in public. Robert, you've written some essays about the politics of sex. One of them being oral sex is hierarchical and Malthusian under liberalism, if I'm not mistaken.
I think the other angle of sex is the Colin Wilson angle, that sex is very much an exploration of consciousness. It's about the physical and about the consciousness. That's the other angle, but very true. The role that oral sex plays under modern society.
I want to break it down for the proles real quick. So if a woman performs oral sex on you, so it matters like your class or something?
Yeah, because I mean, it's hierarchical. So, like, what does it mean? Like, it's kind of a weird, like, leftist, like, inversion. So, like, if, like, a rich white person performs oral sex on, like, a poor black person, it's kind of like a leftist inversion of, like, traditional, like, social hierarchies.
Right, because it really, quote-unquote, should be, like, a wealthy white woman giving oral sex to a wealthy white man, or a poor white woman giving oral...
What about a black incel going down on a rich white Stacey, like something like that.
So that is
what's
like
the politics of that. And now that's an interesting political discourse to say. Or an incel, like what about an incel going down on like a high status like Stacey, or could be a Chad, who knows?
So that's like the inversion kind of what we just said in that, like that would be
it's hierarchical. But the incel is getting access that they're not usually getting access to.
And that would never happen in real life anyway.
I mean, it's not realistic, but it puts forth a pretty... I'd say it's not just about sex, but it puts forth like a new social paradigm. I don't know. I might call it radical centrism, but that comes across as super autistic. But I think it's political. It is politically radical, and it takes apart social, like, tears down, like, existing, like, social hierarchies, and then rebuilds them to create, like, a new social, like, structure.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. I understand that one. And I think I agree with it, too.
It's a metaphor for, like, a new political order.
Matt had something to say about that.
All I was going to say during that discourse was, strange flows, folks, asking the questions that matter.
Yeah, we're not afraid, because we're trying to get to the bottom of this shit.
Yeah.
That's the oral sex essay.
I guess the one question is, so should the partner, I guess the egalitarian way is like, the egalitarian, sexual egalitarianism is having like a looks matched couple who either have missionary position or they have oral sex and it's like totally reciprocal.
That's the ideal.
But that's like the egalitarian ideal, but if you have a big disparity, like where you have like a relationship based on total unreciprocal oral sex. So should the partner receiving automatically be much more attractive or higher in social status?
Yes. Right. They should be more. The person receiving only should be more attractive, right?
And that's a pretty radical political arrangement.
Matt, say something. Why is that radical, Matt? Matt's astounded at the discourse here.
No, I've been through this many times. I don't know if I have any specific additions.
Right. I have to apologize because I just want to understand. So,
No.
Someone attractive is getting the blowjob, and if they're attractive and the person giving it isn't attractive... Is that the ought, right? That's how it should be, right? Am I getting out of it too much?
Yeah, well, it's sort of an interesting thing from just total... it's a different scenario from, like, total social atomization. But I think what's interesting is that... I mean, that scenario actually does happen between men... with, like, women doing that to higher status men... But I think involving like a higher, like an incel and a higher status female, then that's just unreal. I mean, that's unreal. It's more unrealistic. Like a pretty rare, Maybe it's happened, but I'd say it's pretty rare, actually.
It is rare.
But a scenario where, like, I think, like, you even see this in movies sometimes, like an ugly, nerdy woman or who gives head to a Chad. Like, that's actually kind of theme in like, even movies sometimes.
That's more realistic.
I think it's more realistic, okay. But the other scenario, like, I mean, it's probably happened, but I don't think it's that common. But I think promoting it could be, has potential to, like, to be, like, socially and politically radical.
I see what you're saying. So I understand that, Matt. Should we put it into Grug language? Changing the hierarchical nature of blowjobs could alter social...
Well, because I think it's a metaphor. I don't want to, like, make it too much just about sex. It is about sex, but it's a metaphor for social and class hierarchies and arrangements. So, because our society is very hierarchical, but it's also very atomized, and I don't know, like, how to say this without getting, like, too autistic, and I think it's already, we're getting close to, like, peak autism.
This is pretty, we're all pretty autistic. You
know? Yeah, but it's like a metaphor for a new, like, class and social arrangement that's maybe it's not egalitarian, but it manages social arrangements and social hierarchies and class structure is better. Like, it's a metaphor for that.
Because the way I always viewed your oral sex fixation, Robert, is as a metaphor. Yes, it's not really about literally arranging for certain sexual practices to happen, but rather as a metaphor for the way social hierarchy works. And rather than the disguised hierarchies that we have around us and rich people pretending to be poor and poor people wanting so badly to be rich, the power of the oral sex or general sexual BDSM also type metaphors is that it evokes hierarchy in a way that is, at least in theory, pleasurable to all parties. And I think there's something... of that, there's a noblesse oblige. Well, would you say there's a noblesse oblige to rich girls letting incels give them head?
Yeah, like, it is. Because the thing is, like, it is a noblesse oblige. Like, they're giving them access to something that they wouldn't have access to in a million years. But the other thing, I think the other angle is, like, those with status, they don't want to become explicitly, like, exploitative. So in a sense, like, it's that angle, but then it's also, like, being more explicit and visual about, like, the exploitation in, like, a BDSM act.
In the sort of, to take a look at it from a sort of Crowleyan angle of sorts, you know, Crowley and other esotericists would look at the meaning of the position of sex as a kind of yogic, you know, formation.
Tantric.
There's a famous section of the Book of Lies, chapter 69, about, well, 69ing. I don't remember exactly what he says about it, but he, you know, there's this notion that it's like this self-nourishing yin-yang formation. Anyway, there's something to that, to oral sex, whether it's mutual oral sex or just straightforward oral sex, where there's a harmony to the act, right? There's a give and a take. There's a production of pleasure and also a taking of essence that occurs. There's something sort of yogic about it, and I think I view your views on oral sex as sort of tapping into that more esoteric meaning to the significance of oral sex and then applying that politically. I don't know if we need to totally deduce exactly all of it. I just think it's a powerful metaphor, yeah.
And the other angle to it is there's an element of alchemy, or that, like, DNA contains a spiritual force. And I've been thinking, like, some of the early Gnostic sects would actually, like, consume semen as a spiritual ritual. It also makes me think of that. Because, like, so DNA contains a spiritual essence, and you're consuming large quantities of other people's DNA, thus you're consuming their spiritual essence.
No, I think about that shit a lot. You know, there's an element of vampirism to it, too. And, all I can say is I think about this a lot. I mean, I don't know what the upshot is. I don't have a specific prescription for people. Other than that, semen matters. You know, it's not like Monty Python, every sperm is precious necessarily, or that, you know, it's just... It is the essence. I'm a believer in semen retention, etc. and oral sex too is rife with that meaning, and it is nothing short of religious and spiritual as well as biological.
Okay, so we are inferring that semen, cum, whatever, has spiritual essence.
Yeah.
Okay, so vaginal juices as well. So are we also implying that you could, in theory, rub your cum on like a sigil and it'll work? Doesn't this theory also affirm that as well?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, who knows? Like, I can't speak from experience.
I can. I can, but I won't. Continue.
So that's. I'm just accentuating the what that also means for people. So what? Absolutely. Okay. So if you swallow someone's cum, what happens to you energetically?
I think it could have some. The DNA, I'm not sure. Like, it gets accused of a pseudoscience idea that, like, you permanently absorb another person's DNA. But I think there has to be some partial truth to that. Even if it's just, like, as a metaphor.
Just as a metaphor.
If a white person performs a lot of fellatio on a black person, do they, like, adopt, like, black genes? Do they become, like, part black? Or if a woman performs a lot of fellatio on a man, does she adopt like a lot of male testosterone and become more masculine? Or does a man who performs a lot of cunnilingus, like, does he absorb a lot of estrogen and become more feminine?
I think the specifics of that are probably pseudoscientific, but I think it does work as a metaphor. And what I'd say about oral sex specifically, and this is related to what you talk about, Robert, I've often said in a way that you found transfixing, you know, cunnilingus or analingus is most people who have it, they're not thinking about it in any kind of BDSM way, but there is this element of your highest part, your mouth, which is a very verbal, you know, you can talk about it in terms of the chakras. You know, it's a very verbal, personal part of you that you experience the world with, that you talk with. There's a logos element to it. And you're putting it in contact with a lower chakra. What is even the word for the lowest chakra? I don't know, but that's what's down there, right? Whether the root chakra, which is the least, the furthest thing from logos. So there's this inversion that does occur. There is something of yogic significance to that. No doubt, and in this way, it doesn't have to be BDSM, but it is a very specific act of bringing high with low, which is rife with magical potential. Again, Crowley, I haven't even read all that Crowley has said about this, but I think he had actually, in an unironic way, I think he would be very much interested in this conversation about oral sex and what it really means. And of course, in terms of swallowing semen or vaginal juices, in terms of actually swallowing semen, what is this? It is similar to the act of vaginal intercourse, which can produce pregnancy, you know, where two join and create a third, you know, pregnancy. It is just a version of that involves a higher chakra, as it were, or, you know, on the map of the tree of life in Kabbalah, you know, it's a higher up, more logos oriented thing, and it's a specific magical act. I'm not exactly sure what it means, but there's this swallowing of cum, which doesn't do anything. It doesn't produce a third, but maybe it does, but it's only in the spiritual and metaphorical realm. I'm not the expert on the total upshot of all this, so much as to say that a lot of people have oral sex. A lot of people have oral sex with strangers, and I'm not judging anyone's lifestyle choices, but they don't necessarily know what they're doing because it's rife with all of this magical power. It happens all the time.
Here's a thought. So maybe in theory, if you swallow your own cum when you masturbate, which you shouldn't be masturbating.
Why not? Or you shouldn't be masturbating.
Maybe you just...
If you do, you're better off eating
maybe
it.
Maybe you regain your energy back?
Yeah, I think there's some truth to that. Also, I was going to say that
Any thoughts
on eating your own cum when you masturbate, Robert?
Well, you're absorbing your own energy back, so, but it's like, I don't have a strong opinion or strong feelings, but you probably, but sure, you're taking back some of your energy that you're losing. It's like, maybe it's like a new, like the semen retention, but maybe that's some kind of compromise of semen retention.
I think it is. And the other thing I was going to say, current events, I'm not a big fan of Megan Fox and Machine Gun Kelly or whatever. There was some, I only heard about this through my girlfriend, who was, you know, talking about it in a sort of tabloid way, but I guess they, like, drank each other's blood or something, and everyone was horrified by this. I'm not necessarily endorsing that, but what Megan Fox said in response was, like, well, you suck a stranger's dick, you eat a stranger's cum, is what she said. It's like, a lot of people do that. Like, why is this worse? And I kind of agree. It's like, I'm not saying people should be vampires or drink each other's blood, but if you have some ritual reason for doing that with someone you actually know and love and trust, I mean, yeah, is that really worse than eating a stranger's cum? I'm inclined to say no, because the difference between vampirism and eating cum may be less different than we'd like to think. Yeah, and obviously, Robert, a lot of this, you've written about this on Substack, but a lot of it is sort of articulated in the symbolism of the seats that appear in both, the coffins / the seats that appear in both of your books, the sort of forced oral sex metaphorical scenario you have in both your novels, and we could talk about that more, but I would say people should just read your work to see how this stuff is explored.
Robert, in this conversation, is there anything you'd like to expound upon more regarding that politics, the politics of of oral sex essay that we haven't maybe done justice to?
I don't really have a lot more to say, but I think a lot of these new arrangements, they seem unrealistic, but I would like to see like avant-garde art being promoted as a vehicle to promote it. And like, I'd like to see, at some point, I'd like to see like a movie about this and I really get out into the culture.
About oral sex. Would it be a porno or would it be an art film in a non euphemistic sense?
It would be an art film, but it would be erotic.
It would be X-rated.
It might, and it could be R-rated, but it might have to be X-rated. But I just want to see this concept get pushed out into the culture, not just something like fringe, like something that like people of social standing are like discussing. Like, even normies need to be discussing this, too. Like, it can't just be in the fringe. It has to be, like, it has to be something, like, you would see, like, a mainstream, like, feminist publication, like, writing about.
Yeah, I don't disagree, and I agree that there's a lot of interesting filmic potential in this.
It's also, I think one more thing to add, it's a way to kind of troll the gender wars.
Yes.
Because it is, because you're kind of, it's a way to... You're kind of fucking with feminism, but you're also kind of co-opting some of their dialectic at the same time, and even some of their grievances. So that angle's interesting, too.
Yeah, it is, and we met with Susan Block, the sex doctor, Susan Block, who, not exactly, well, she is a feminist. She's more interesting than most feminists, but that was an example of us doing it in real life, I guess.
Yeah.
I'll link to that in the description here. Cause have you ever seen that, Evan?
I have.
Yeah, it's something else.
She actually had a show of about, I can't believe, like, she had me like, whip a guy in a Trump mask.
This happened 2018.
I voted for Trump in 2016, which made it even more weird.
Indeed. Should we go in?
Yeah, I feel like we've talked about all this stuff.
All
this
stuff.
We can talk about normal things now.
We can talk about normal things now. All right, should we continue? Yeah, this is cool.
Right there. I'll sit here.
Is that cool?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to go to the bathroom.
Okay.
Wherever you want.
Yeah. Actually.
Thank you. Here's an interesting question, Robert. Can you tell me what's wrong with Christianity?
Yeah, to start things off, I think like a flaw with Christianity is the moral authoritarianism, which influences a lot of like modern politics. A lot of problems with politics is that there's any lack of dualism and this applies, I mean, beyond both to the left and right in politics, and, like, the lack of nuance, and how, like, without getting into too much detail on policy, how an issue is instead about finding the right balance, like, balance on an issue of, like, contracting, like you could say, like, a yin and a yang, like, the contrast of two components to a political issue. Instead of finding balance, people think in, like, good versus bad binary, and that, I think that is an influence from Christianity. So theosophy, as, like, an alternative, must influence politics, including dualism. But, yeah, theosophy needs to be, like, the foundation for politics. And the thing about, like, you take something like morality is you do have, it's not promoting, like, nihilism or total moral relativism. You have to kind of decide, like, what things are absolutes that you could say are influenced by either the divine or by nature. And then you have to figure out, like, how much morality is just, I don't know, kind of bullshit, or not necessarily bullshit, but just like a product of, like, socialization, and how much morality is situational. Like, does it serve a purpose in a specific circumstance?
I see. Thank you.
Thank you.
In order to establish those ideals, do you think that would require, and this kind of segues into NRX, but more so, like, kind of like a prophet, so to speak, or, like, can the government legislate those, the values of those morals, or who do you think would do that, perhaps?
Well, I think, like, a whole, it's going to take, like, a spiritual, cultural, like, kind of revolutionary movement, but I don't really have, I mean, as far as implementing it, I don't really have the answer for that.
Hmm. Oh, thank you.
You.
Oh, yeah?
I guess another example is, like kind of like a radical center where you have, like, progressive solutions to a, like, right-wing view of human nature. That could be an example of it. But I think the other issue is that Christianity lacks an answer to how people are spiritually different due to biology, and how, like, people being spiritually different due to biological factors affects questions of morality and questions of salvation. So think about, like, when Christians talk about salvation, a very specific personality type which is linked to biology affects whether someone is saved or not. So if you accept that premise, then either you go in two directions. Either you become, like, a Calvinist and you believe in predestiny, or you basically go in a theosophical direction. But there are major flaws. I mean, to show you, like, major flaws of, like, evangelical, like, Christianity. But I think some counterpoint I'll actually add is, even as, like, a theosophist, I do think that you could say, like, there is some historical legitimacy to Christianity, and there is a good chance that Jesus could have existed. It's just the question is, like, how much was changed or corrupted, like, later on. So I'm not even necessarily anti-Christian. Like, there is a lot of value in the Christian mystics, from, like, Swedenborg to Meister Eckhart and William James, or even the Neoplatonist influence on Christianity, like, with the theologian Origen. And Origen was the theologian who invented, he came up with the concept of the Trinity.
Really?
Maybe, I don't know if you would say came up with it, but he...
He cemented it.
Cemented it,
it.
Yeah, exactly. And he was basically Neoplatonist. So Neoplatonism influenced Christianity. But then, do you think, like, the appeal of Christianity is that it's a very simple religion, which I don't mean that as actually an insult. I think that's part of its appeal, but it is true that around the time of, like,
really, ethically especially, it's a pretty simple religion, yeah.
And there's a case for that. Does that, I don't even mean that in a derogatory sense, but, like, when in the late Roman Empire, like, Christianity appealed to the Roman proletariat, while Neoplatonism did to the patrician class. So maybe you could say, like, there's, like, the highest gods, and then there's, like, demons, and then, but maybe, like, is there also, like, a god of the normies who deals with things like petty moralism?
So would Christianity be the petty moralism that you would follow?
I wouldn't.
Yeah.
necessarily say that, but that could be. It's like the Gnostics have like the Demiurge.
Bring up an interesting topic that the Gnostics might think of the Demiurge as like the god of the normies, as it were, because I think that is. It's both one of the things that's interesting about Gnosticism, and one of its pitfalls, I think, is that it attracts people who like to think they are better than others.
I mean, not everybody can be an epic Freemason,
no,
cultist.
Say, I would definitely...
I believe in hierarchy, and not, I'm not really into egalitarianism, so I do believe some people are better than others, and therefore that's one of the appeals of Gnosticism, is there may be a deeper level for some people. However, I also think it's you're playing with fire when you tell people, oh, you understand something no one else does, it attracts the wrong type of people. People who maybe are legitimately more intelligent get corrupted. These issues are not easy to resolve. So that's why I both like and dislike Gnosticism, I guess, at the same time.
And in regards to occultism, since I kind of brought that up, do you think that shit's evil or anything like that, or like the sex magic we were talking about?
Interpretation of occultism, like there's white magic and dark magic. I think the main flaw with occultism is that it's just because there's all this gatekeeping and it is elitist, which obviously said elitism can be a good thing, spiritual elitism, but I feel it's kind of incoherent and there's a lack of practical ways to practice it. Mm-hmm. But I really like Colin Wilson's talk on consciousness and consciousness as like a practical mysticism or occultism, but like theurgy comes into this too, so theurgy even has an influence in like Catholicism, but using visual aesthetics to create a spiritual experience, that's what theurgy is, that's an example. So matter versus consciousness creates reality, so shifting consciousness, but also finding ways to alchemize matter, that's basically the essence of mysticism and the occult.
So with elites... So is it pretty much predetermined, predestined that elites will always be like epic occultists, like because it's an elitist thing to do?
I don't know. Like I feel a lot of the cultist stuff you get from the cultist stuff about occultic elites from conspiracy theorists is over. A lot of it is overblown, and
yeah,
it's sort of used as a way. It comes back from like Christians using it to demonize like pagans.
I see. And kind of combining two questions together regarding the future of California and America, what type of religion is the future of America contingent on to survive, and how do you see that playing out, and what do you think of that? Like,
I really have no idea, but I do predict like a new religious revival, which seems to come along about every century. So you have like the 1840s with the Transcendentalists, the 1940s like the Pentecostals, and however you also had like the New Wave movement from like the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So like a sort of resurgence in cults. We could also see some kind of like new Christian revival, because you see like traditional Christianity in decline. Like we do, I don't know. Like I could put forth like.
All good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, that looks really good. That's me.
Okay.
And thanks so much, Rice, too.
Yes,
cool.
Yes, I'll get it.
Thank you.
Can you hold it?
Got it.
Right,
thanks very
you.
Much.
Ooh, it's great. Is this haunted?
What's haunted?
It's just standing up on its own. I don't
know
why
that's
so impressive
me,
to me.
That's me, I did that.
Yeah, no doubt.
Can you read it?
Anyway, so we got some, I got some lamb vindaloo, Matt
What's
got some...
vindaloo and curry?
I think mine has potatoes. And there's a few other different things.
And then
you got a curry. What'd you get to eat?
The vegetarian tally.
Cool.
You're mostly vegetarian, right, Robert? You want to talk about that?
Mostly vegetarian, but not entirely. But
is that like a stomach thing, or is that for your spiritual wellness? Ah, thank you. We have some garlic naan.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very, very much. All right, so going back to that,
the perfect food for a slightly cold, day.
So the thing is, like, Matt and I were going to start a new religion and never really took off, but it was like a spark that led to this journey. But anyhow, like, I do predict,
so
like,
you would give me credit as sparking your existence of this stuff.
Well, yeah, somewhat. But yeah, like I do predict
can you,
like
can you say that in a soundbite that you give every single.
Okay, so we just finished eating. We're going to continue on the problems, the future of America's civil religion, what that would be like. It's kind of like a Christian revival. Oh, yeah, the rise of cults you kind of mentioned, right, Robert?
Yeah. I see new religions and cults forming, and it could also be a Christian revival, so I don't know. Like, what it will look like. It's interesting because the alternative history prediction YouTuber, What If Altus, he predicts that California and the West Coast will have a new religion that will be, like, new agey, but, like, will take, like, wokeness and put it into, like, a future religion. He actually predicted that in one of his videos, which is interesting. But, like, new revival. I used to see, like, a lot of new Christian sects forming. Or, I mean, because right now Christianity is on a decline, and the country is becoming more secular, but it's like people say, like, wokeness is a religion, and it kind of is, but, like, MAGA is a cult. You could say, like, Trump is a deity to many, even if those people would, like, call themselves... He's an avatar, yeah.
Steve Bannon describes him as a man in time, so that's under the supposition of Devi's... inference that you know, Hitler was a man out of time, I think,
man against time
or something like that. But so this will segue into what we're still talking about, this preemptive question. Would you describe yourself as a Californian enclavist?
Yeah, I would.
Okay, so with that in mind, what would a specifically Californian civic religion look like? Would it incorporate the bear at all, that's on the flag, or anything like that?
I have no idea what's going to happen, but I'd like to see, like, a California version of theosophy that is, like, maybe tailored to enclavism. I'd like to see that, but who knows if it's... I mean, not saying that I think that will happen, but that's what I'd like to see.
Perhaps, like, the surfer bro dialects, kind of like that smoke weed, right, cool chill guy thing. Is that going to be, you think, maybe a part of how people will act in a California enclave?
Could be.
Okay. And on the topic of California,
that's a major subculture. So, like, enclavism includes, it could be ethnic, but it could include, like, the many different subcultures in California.
But yeah, there's quite a few.
Yeah, and a lot of people have, like, multiple identities, so that might get kind of a little chaotic.
Have you seen the film Boys in the Hood?
I think a long time ago.
Wow, that's a really good one. Well,
John Singleton, right?
Yeah, I believe.
I want to watch more John Singleton films. I've heard there's also one where Michael Rapaport becomes like a white nationalist. I want to watch that one.
Oh wow.
I don't think I've seen it. Maybe I've seen clips of it.
The reason why I bring it up is because I suppose that's part of kind of the black subculture of not necessarily being a gangster criminal, but just kind of that, you know, that style of hip-hop, like Kendrick Lamar, that'd be, like, the black subculture in a California enclavist society, and then there's the whites, and they have, like, the surfer thing kind of going on, and then there's the woods people, and I guess they're kind of more, like, Oregonians kind of vibe.
Well, sort of today has been Robert may come on this adventure to Lassen Volcanic National Park.
Well, I'll go to the state of Jefferson territory for the first time in my life.
Yeah, we're the state of the quote-unquote state of Jefferson. So Robert will expand his journeying in California, which is important because he's one of our greatest California scholars.
That's very true. And, you know, on that...
I've been to the Bay Area many times. I've been to Sacramento, but I've never been to, like, the really far north part of California before.
What do you think of Gavin Newsom?
I think he's terrible, but I mean, I think he's terrible. But, like, the question is, like, how effective he is as, like, being a technocrat. And, like, some people say, like, he's perfect for sort of, like, this managed decline. But I also get a feeling that he's sort of like the Democrats' Ron DeSantis, where he was, like, overhyped for the next president, but he ended up being a failure as a candidate. So, but I do think. Like, I think he's terrible, but I do think he's important.
Terrible, but not entirely incompetent, would you say?
No, entirely. I think he's important as like an archetype, as like a technocrat who's overseeing like a managed decline. And maybe if that's his purpose, then I can't say he's bad at what he's doing. If that's his purpose.
Yeah, he seems kind of like Trudeau as well. Like just like a
Does remind me of Trudeau. Like
higher T than Trudeau, but yes.
Yeah, for sure.
So Gavin Newsom, why would he want? Like, why is California declining?
A lot of different factors, but the thing is, it's like, it's kind of a slow decline. I do think, like, I get, like, these right-wing media figures who they overhype it and they exaggerate it, and they're all, like for clickbaits, and it's like, where we are now, like, our day-to-day, we had a pretty nice day, and I don't think, like walking around right now, like downtown Santa Barbara necessarily feels like in some big, it doesn't really meet the image of like how it's portrayed, like where these right wing media channels will like hand pick like Skid Row in downtown or the Tenderloin in San Francisco and these homeless encampments just to prove everything's like. I mean, California is a great place to live if you can afford it, and it has many problems, but I would say it's in decline. But it feels more this kind of stagnant, slow decline rather than the image that the right-wing media... But it's not. It's far from having, like, any kind of, like, renaissance. But it's more like a... It's very atomized, and it's kind of deracinated as having the role of, like, a colony of a colony. But I do think California is very significant, has a significance, like, to spirituality, including New Age spirituality, but also, like, religious sects and cults, including, like, Christian sects, like, with the Michael Marinacci book, California Jesus.
California Jesus.
Oh, yeah. I know it, too. But
you read it, or...?
I've read parts of it. Michael Marinacci is someone Robert and I interviewed. He spoke at PRS last year. He was a contributor to Weird California, you know, part of the Weird series, like Weird New Jersey.
Oh, right.
He did Weird California. He was one of the writers, and he wrote a book called California Jesus about Christian sects that started in California, of which there are many, of varying quality. Some are just simply a little weird. Some are downright cultish, occult-oriented, Children of God being the worst example. We were reading it because we were, at the time, researching Mel Gibson's father for that documentary I was talking about.
I don't want to get too much into the drama, but I have no clue what's happening with that. Like, I have no clue what happened with that Mel Gibson documentary.
Yeah, I guess we should say that because some people might listen and ask. So I guess it's on hiatus, shall we say. But Michael Marinacci's book, California Jesus, covers Mel Gibson funded a state of a conscious Latin mass church in Malibu, which is by invite only. It's very exclusive. But that's why we were reading. Anyway, Marinacci is an interesting figure. I don't want to derail the conversation. I don't remember where we were. But one last question. So we're integrating this now into the podcast. Literally, the idea came just today of Robert, you joining this trip that I'm going to be doing to Northern California. I'm going to be seeing Lassen Volcanic National Park, as mentioned, Sacramento, Redwoods. We're also going to stop through San Francisco. And San Francisco has been getting a bad rep. It's been getting a lot of press for having high crime, which as you were saying, you know, maybe it's a little bit selective, but it does seem like San Francisco is a good deal worse than L.A. When was the last time you were in San Francisco, and are you going to be kind of curious to see? We're going to be staying near Union Square, which is specifically a part that was said to get worse. So what are your thoughts on that, or what are you expecting to see? What are you hoping to see?
I think the last time I went to San Francisco, I forget. I think it was with you.
Yeah,
2021.
Yeah.
And
it wasn't that bad.
It wasn't as bad. I mean, it seems like there was a lot less foot traffic, as I remember it, like, prior to the pandemic. But it wasn't as bad as the media is, like, a lot of the media makes it out to be.
Right. So I guess we'll see if the more recent reporting on that is more of this. I mean, there's undeniably bad things that have happened. I guess, what did they close? Some of those famous department stores in Union Square? And we're staying basically in Union Square, so we will see.
The big mall, the San Francisco Shopping Center.
Right, so that was last year. Maybe it's not. I've also heard it's back on the upswing. I don't know. I haven't been in 2 years now, too. So we shall see. But it's basically, this is getting into the nuts and bolts, and we can move on to the next question. Is the reason Union Square got hit, you think, because it's next to Tenderloin? Basically, the badness of the Tenderloin started to spread. Is that your impression on that?
I think our hotel we're staying is kind of on the border of Union Square and the Tenderloin, but that was a big part of it. But it was also like remote work. There was also a lot of office vacancies because Union Square also appealed. There's issues with like the homelessness and the Tenderloin, but also Union Square also appealed a lot to office workers from the financial district who, with remote work, were no longer there.
I see.
All I wanted to say was white civil rights laws. What do you think about that?
I don't think it's viable under the one-party democratic rule, but I think California would be better off under something like the Swiss Canton model, or maybe like Singapore's version of multiculturalism, where it's a neutral or symmetrical like multiculturalism, where every group is just treated as like balanced, having their own interests and legitimate, but there isn't this without the kind of whole majoritarian versus minority oppressor dialectic.
I see. And kind of moving on, still talking about the California, I want to talk about a lot of sympathizers or people who sympathize with the concept of NRX, the neo-reactionary movement in America. What do you think about that, as well as do you think that could, employing that, maybe a more powerful Newsom character could fix California? Maybe we'll talk about NRX first.
Yeah, NRX. Yeah.
As a philosophy.
As a philosophy, and they have, there's many different figures. They do have a lot of legitimate criticisms of liberal democracy. But, I think they're great in their assessment and critique of the problems, but they come short of offering solutions. And with the Arvin, he seems to want tech CEOs to become monarchs, which I think is a terrible idea.
Why is that a terrible idea?
Because obviously they're people motivated very much by I don't think that capitalism leads to the best elites.
Oh, so a better elites would be a more aristocratically feudal type of birthing, kind of?
There's problems with hereditary monarchs as well, but some kind of, the question is, I think you want people who are on the highest level, intellectually, as far as creativity and spirituality, but I think it's harder, coming out as, how do you actually select for that? How do you implement that? That's much trickier, and there's, ideal, Plato's ideal of, the guardian caste. But I would favor some kind of city-state models with, they could be democratic democracies on a small scale, but also they could also restrict democracy. I think one of my most radical ideas is testing people's brainwaves for spiritual traits, how strong their brainwaves are in a reaction to something. It could be just beauty or nature, as simple as that. And then selecting for an elite kind of caste based on those traits. But it does almost sound a bit I'm not necessarily pro Scientology. It sounds a bit like Scientology, but it's probably unrealistic. But that's probably one of my most radical or controversial views.
I thought more of Dune, but anyway. So these people would be in a politburo of aristocrats.
Select probably I think the best way to select for an aristocracy is testing brainwaves for how strong of a spiritual reaction people have.
That's pretty cool. Talking about NRX again. Are there any other thinkers that you're aware of, Yarvin?
H.P. Lovecraft advocated ended up being a New Deal supporter, and he started off on the right, but he advocated aristocratic socialism with the most intellectual people as the aristocracy.
I see, and I recall in one of your interviews you talked about that there needs to be some sort of harmony between the castes of warriors and shopkeepers and stuff.
But I guess Plato talked about it, proportional inequality or kind of a tripartite system, so capitalism is ruled by the merchants, but there has to be some kind of balance, because I think the problem fascism is rule of the warrior caste, and that's kind of fits in with what BAP idealizes that, but that obviously didn't work out. Communism is an attempt of like dictatorship of the proletariat, that didn't work out. Capitalism's rule of the merchant, that's been a big failure. So I think the ideal is some kind of like proportional inequality where you balance these different like archetypes.
I think so too. I mean, that just clearly just makes the most sense. I'm not sure about you, Strange Flows listener. I'm going to pass over the mic to Matt now. You got any thoughts, Matt?
What was just said a moment ago?
An ideal society would be a syncretic division of warriors, shopkeepers, the proletariat class, all kind of having like a say.
Mm-hmm.
Society, instead of capitalism being the rule of the merchant class or fascism being the rule of the warrior class.
No, I think there's some truth to that. I think, and I know you're talking about Yarvin and such, and I think some of the monarchists would say that monarchy could best facilitate that on some level. I mean, there is something in the medieval society where you had the priests, the warriors, and the merchants, right, and as well as the peasants. And the only thing I'd really say about that, without co-signing on any particular ideology, is that I am reminded of Tarot. You know, the people often will say that swords, cups, pentacles, and wands all correspond to different social classes. Swords being warriors, pentacles being merchants, cups being priests. What's the one I'm missing? Wands. Wands being peasants, usually, actually. It doesn't map perfectly onto most people's understanding of tarot, but as with tarot, I mean, I think there's the notion of harmony that can come out of these four things interacting. So on an esoteric level, I think, you know, I agree, and I think this extends to other areas of life besides politics.
I just had an interesting question for Robert. Regarding what a monarch would look like in the future, I'm reminded of the physiognomy of Barron Trump, and I also think of BAP. And would a future monarch just be like a really buff-looking Caesar who is really smart?
Could be.
Hmm.
Could be. Well, no, I mean, that doesn't guarantee greatness as a leader either. But I guess if you go by it with BAP, as a lot of things. I'm really fascinated with BAP. I enjoy listening to his podcasts, but I think he places a strong sense on like the warrior as like the ideal ruler, and that was kind of. I mean, he gets accused of being like a fascist, but actually, like, fascism was rule of the warrior caste, and fascism. I think fascism, like, you can tell. Have a nuanced take on it, but I still think it was overall a negative thing.
Was Mussolini really like a warrior, though? I mean, he seemed like kind of just big guy, didn't really fight.
It is
true that, and I'm not the expert on fascism or history, but it is true that almost all the fascist leaders, Hitler, Mussolini, and even Franco, who I know less about than the other two, to be honest, but and perhaps even Juan Perón, who's not a fascist per se, but who's a little bit of that ilk, they all were militant military figures. There is this sense, even though they themselves were not warriors.
Yeah,
there was
not who they were. I mean, like,
their role as commander in chief and general was part and parcel of their leadership. So maybe that, and military might was
huge. It's interesting because, like, someone like Ezra Pound, who was like the archetype of like the struggling failed artist, he ended up supporting Mussolini, and he had this like political kind of this esoteric fascism where he believed like the artist should be like the ruling class.
Yeah.
You have figures like Wyndham Lewis, H.P. Lovecraft, who
were like art fascists who thought.
Oh, David Bowie for a short time was.
And the person who brings if you're setting out a dichotomy between the art fascist and the warrior fascist, Ernst Jünger is the man. And then these two things come together, not even to suck his dick, but just like you can see where the connection could be drawn. Or art is war by other means. Et cetera, et cetera.
What about Oscar Wilde?
Well, what about him? I mean, he was an aristocratic elite. These variations break down. I was actually going to add a point that, not that anyone needs debunking as to whether or not Donald Trump is a fascist, but the best way to really push against that point is that there's really nothing, there's very little in him of the warrior, or even of the particularly involved general. Obviously, the President of the United States is technically the, in charge of the military, but the Trump doesn't really have that warlike flavor, and in fact has been an anti-war candidate. So you could really, I think of the many arguments you could make against Trump being a fascist per se, or the abuse of that word when applied to him, I think that's the best one, is that he's not militant. But to your point with Oscar Wilde, it's like, yeah, he is a certain kind of aristocratic radical. Trump is too, in a very Americanized way. So there's a difference between just being aristocratic and being a fascist. But the borderlines are going to get gray. But by most meaningful definitions of fascism, I do think you really need that military angle. I think that defines it much better if it's going to be a meaningful historical category.
When you take Hitler, like, his background was as an artist, but he's still true. So, like, but he chose to, this focus point of the politics was, like, there, he had a strong emphasis on, like, the arts, and there was, like, Wagner, but there's still, like, the strong focus was still on militarism.
Right.
That's what defined National Socialism.
He came to praise, not that I'm an expert on this, but even with Wagner, it's like, you know, for national greatness. There's like military music, and I don't know exactly what painting he was praising in the end, but it was kind of subsumed by the nationalism and the militarism, which most people, even from a right-wing perspective, would say is a kind of compromise of the fundamental attitude there.
And a quick note, if we recall that that discourse about Hitler's art, just to quickly talk about it, just looking at the type of art it was just kind of it was a formalist,
yeah,
like formalist landscapes, and there was a lot of discourse regarding, well, he was really bad at spacing or whatever,
yeah.
But that just goes to show the type of art that Hitler that he liked.
Yeah, you have people, it's like, this goes back to like the moral authoritarianism that has an influence from like Abrahamic faiths, like. It's like, because he did really horrific, evil things, you can't find, like, you have to say, like, his heart was evil, too. It's this kind of weird, like, moral authoritarianism. Like, I don't think, he wasn't, like, Van Gogh, but his art wasn't terrible, either.
Something to note that you said earlier, Matt, was that art is war.
Who coined that? Art is war by other means.
The quote is, politics is war by other means, and I'm just literally copy pasting it. But you know, you could make an argument that, you know, art is a man who is denied a chance to fight with tooth and nail and beak and claw, instead finds, you know, aesthetic creation as another means of asserting himself. It's pretty loose. Politics is war by other means in a more direct sense than art is. But I think you could say that a lot about what Uncle Ted would have called surrogate activities, you know, that they are the channeling of some kind of seminal sort of instinct that could otherwise have been stirred about. For most artists, they're not warlike people, but you have examples like Junger, who are both, and even Ernest Hemingway on a more leftward side, I guess, who are, you know, have that instinct to battle and greatness, but also put it into art.
Yeah, like, exactly regarding putting it into art, maybe in the future, this monarch will be an epic memer, and he's just really good at mimetic philosophy, and he creates great memes that are very prolific, even about himself, as we saw with Trump's election, you know, campaign in 2016, like, the memes flowed.
Yeah.
And on that note, please listen to Robert's podcast. Please read his Substack. Subscribe to his stuff. Buy his books. They're really good, and he's very smart and a great artist. And everybody's sleeping on him. And you really should just listen to what Robert has to say about everything regarding California politics, American domestic politics. You don't really do that much foreign policy, or
a little bit.
Geopolitics,
a little bit.
A little bit. Am I missing anything else that you do, Robert?
Stop.
robertstarksub.substack.com.
Right, and the books are Journey to Vapor Island and Vapor Fornia. Right now, the best way to get them is to just Google those things, and you'll find them on Lulu.
Yeah, Lulu.
One day they'll be on Amazon, and hopefully more people will read them because they're great. But follow Robert Starkian. If you don't have the digits in front of you, that's fine. He's readily findable on Twitter.
Is there anything you want to leave the audience with, Robert?
I think we covered a lot of stuff. I don't have anything else more to add. I just want to say it was great speaking with both of you, Matt and Evan. It was a really great interview. Thanks, guys.
Yeah. Thanks. It's a real honor. This has been Strange Flows. We'll catch you later.
Say.